We should start, Will, with I'll just begin here. We had a podcast. We were having a conversation. We were talking about your new book, and I had to leave in the middle of it for reasons that are probably not all clear. But I think that's a good place to start our conversation. I'm with author Will Leach of the book The Time Has Come, former colleague. We were both special to the Post-Dispatch. We also got to work with probably the person who is most special to the Post-Dispatch, and that is the late, great Rick Hummel. Will, thank you for joining me. I want to start just by, you grew up a Cardinal fan. That means you grew up getting your hands on the Post-Dispatch as often as possible. And does that mean that you grew up clipping and reading and following the Rick Hummel byline?
Of course. I mean, I remember the first time I had a piece in the Post-Dispatch, and it was, I think Hummel had a notebook, Sunday notebook. Cause it's after, that's exactly what it was. It would have been a Sunday notes column, the day, after I'd filed probably a sidebar on one play that the backup strong safety made in a game that I never remember and will never think about again. And I was like, I'm on the same page as Rick Hummel. I'm like 18 years old, 19 years old to be on the same page. And it's funny because once I finally got to meet him later, I actually did not want to tell him that story. Not because I don't know how he would take it, but to me, it was just like, the thing that was exciting about that was not, it wasn't so much that I was excited that I was on the same page of Rick Hummel. I felt bad for Rick Hummel that since someone is as hallowed at him would have to share it with some 19-year-old snot-nosed college student. I mean, it was Rick Hummel, for crying out loud. So of course, you know, I have, I remember there's an old Post-Dispatch book that I think I got for Christmas while I was doing Deadspin, by the way, back in like 2006, 2007, where it was commissioned the Cardinals, the most memorable games as covered by him. And it was really, you know, I mean, I remember when he did the book with La Russa, The One Last Strike, after the infamous 2011 game. It was just like, well, of course, that has to be the guy that does that. And I think that the respect that he had from players, from managers, and most of all, frankly, from readers, and most of all, really the people that worked with him. I mean, I joked about this on Twitter, but like I was at a Braves game with my dad, literally wearing my throwback Cardinals blue jersey, but I think it said FAM on the back, by the way. And Rick walked through, and I was like, okay, I'm sorry, Dad, forgive me, but I'm gonna like take this. Get a picture with this guy. He's like, who is that? He didn't recognize his name. He's like, Rick Hummel. He's like, oh, can I get one? I mean, that kind of excitement is, where, you know, this is a business full of jaded people, right? You know, people, the idea like, oh, that person's doing okay. Well, I could do that. Or, oh, good for them, I guess. And Hummel was someone that was revered the minute he walked in anywhere. There was a kindness and a goodness and just a gentleness that I think represented not just, the profession, but really St. Louis baseball, and in the way it was reflected and respected, he was a perfect example of that. So yeah, I can't believe. I'm not even a thousandth as close to him as you were.
Our close friend Bernie Miklas had this line. He referred to him as, you know, we all call him like a prince of the press box, right? Because we love our alliteration. But Bernie called him an ambassador of St. Louis. And I kind of like that. I like that he was out there representing St. Louis and St. Louis baseball, because he's a lot of what that standard is set like, you know, right? Like, you know, it's beer and baseball and the arch is how St. Louis presents itself to the world. And the fact that he was part of that baseball element, like just the writer who gave voice to so much history and gave voice to so many players and added to the lore and the history of the game. I like that phrase, that he was an ambassador, a representative of sort of the best of what St. Louis baseball writing and journalism had to offer. Did you meet him first as a fan or as a sports writer on a credential?
I've actually almost met him almost exclusively as a fan. In fact, I don't know if you've noticed this, when I have been, because I try to avoid the Cardinals press box. I've been spent a lot of time in other press boxes, but I actually try to avoid the Cardinals press box because I can generally do the best I can to provide the illusion of I'm a serious reporter that when I'm covering like a Mets game or like a Knicks game or an Atlanta Braves game, that is very difficult. That's impossible for me to do when it comes to the Cardinals. So I try to avoid the press box if I can, but I usually like to stop by if I'm doing something beforehand. And one of the things I kind of, so I have actually, I've worked alongside him, but like almost in my own little silo, because I felt like what I was doing, I don't get to be like, you get to sit next to Rick Hummel. Bernie gets to sit next to Rick Hummel. I get to genuflect. and I don't mean that to sound like hero worshipy, but like, you know, I think that I have such profound respect for what not only he did, but you do. And that is a sacred thing. And I think I do. I mean, like, one of the things I think I admire a lot about you is one of the similar things I admired about him. You just get out and you do it every day. You get out and you do it and you're there. And there was an understanding of you do that for such a long time. There is an institutional knowledge and an institutional memory is there, and you find yourself fortunate that he is the caretaker of that. He's the lighthouse keeper of that in a lot of ways. And so it's funny. People have always asked me, one of the things I forget about this profession, because now I live in Athens, Georgia. I don't hang out with anyone in the media. I kind of like it, if I'm being entirely honest. I don't spend a lot of time with people in the media anymore. And so every time someone asks me, like, what do you do? I'm like, I'm a writer. I cover sports. I write novels. I cover sports. Like, and they don't care, like, oh, what's that like? Or what do you know? Or so on. They want to know, wait, have you talked to LeBron? Have you talked to Jeter? Have you ever met him? That's all they ever want to know. And I'm all like, actually, I don't find athletes. I don't see an athlete like, oh, that's so cool that I did this. That's so cool I did that. But it's cool that I met Rick Hummel. It's cool. Like, those are my heroes. Like, my heroes, the people that I look at and be like, oh, I can't believe I just talked to Rick Hummel. I'm getting a selfie with Rick Hummel. Those are the people I find myself really admiring and almost getting starstruck about. So I would not raise myself to what I do when I'm in a press box to what Rick and really you and do. It feels like that's a bigger, more revered, more important thing than whatever quips I might have to have.
I like that image. I talk a lot about, like, with the Cardinals, about, you know, the players or the executives who become a steward of it. Like, think of the Cardinals as a public trust, not a business, right? Like, it's raised to that level. And whether you see that as their brand or their commitment to the city or whatever, all of that. But also the fact that, like, if you are going to say Stan Musial is the best of us and Stan Musial stands for what we are as an organization, then you are more than a business. You are a steward of that, a custodian even. And actually, former manager Mike Matheny and I would talk about this notion, this steward notion. And I like the way you describe that you know, Hummel was the lighthouse keeper for something that was lit before he got there. But man, he made it shine brighter. I mean, like, he took what Bob Brake gave him, you know, and the beat writers before him and shined it up and kept it glowing for five decades. I want to ask you this, and then we'll run for folks the podcast we had planned. As a writer, Rick was mischievous, man. You would read his things and he was intricate on deadline, which is super hard to do. He'd have these little barbs in there that, you know, like, sometimes reading his game stories were like smelling the roses, right? You're like, oh man, this is really good. This is really good. And then you reach out to pluck one and it pricks you. as a writer, like, how'd you read them? And specifically as you revisited, like, those stories from your youth there back when they reprinted them.
Yeah, but of course, you know, it's funny. I was talking about the Commission, the Cardinals book, but, like, it's funny because, you know, those are, of course, all the stories of really awesome things happening with the Cardinals.
Right, right.
Like, they're all, like, and those are great stories, and those are great stories to write on deadline, and he was obviously really great at that. But one of the fun things, you know, listen, when you follow a sports team, you follow it all the time. In the off season, every day, we're talking right now, the day after the Cardinals lost in extra innings to the Reds, and I went back and read everything I could about that, and I will have that, and I will think about that game when I'm watching tonight's game, and I will think about that the next week. But it's a daily thing. I always say that baseball is like a river, which is to say you can totally get in there every single day and like play in it and totally luxuriate in it, or you can just maybe drive over on a bridge and wave to it if you're busy with something else. And like, but baseball is always there. And so when you have someone that covers the beat so well and is on it all the time, you not only get a feel for how the team's going, you get a feel for, you are in many ways seeing the team through their eyes. It's a wonderful, like I always say, my hero growing up writing was Roger Ebert. And I often, whenever I read a Roger Ebert review, I didn't know whether I would like the movie or not, but I understood why he did. I understood his perspective. I would sometimes watch a movie and be like, oh, Ebert's going to love that. Or, oh, Ebert's not going to like that. And I feel like that is something that you would get from Hummel. I always like, whenever things were going on, and listen, the Cardinals are a pretty fortunate franchise. They've had more good things going on than bad. But he also covered the team when Whitey Herzog left. And when Joe Torre was the Joe Torre time and the brief Mike LaFieber week or whatever, Mike Jorgensen week of doing that. So like, you know, I think that the way that he would cover that, particularly someone that lived in New York for 13 years and saw what I would argue is the kind of lizard brain dumb version of covering bad times. I think that idea of the public trust, he would write about the Cardinals when things were bad, with correctly pointing out things that were wrong and with that kind of barb, but with a general understanding of this is an ongoing story. This is something that happened, that this is an ongoing story with plot lines from 10 years ago and 15 years ago. And in 10 or 15 years, the story is still going to be going on. And I think that allowed him to, when things were going poor, to like be able to correctly note them and note the things that were wrong and get that little barb that you're talking about in there, but without ever feeling like this guy's just sitting in the sidelines taking pot shots.
Absolutely.
And the warmth, and there was a warmth of it that came across that was undeniable. And that was the thing. When you're a baseball fan, and particularly when you're a Cardinals fan, like, I'm 47 years old. I've been watching this team since I was 6. God forbid, hopefully I'll make another 41 years and I'll be watching when I'm 88. And that's the same story. That is the same story from 6 to 88. I will remember Ozzie's homer in 85. I will remember Glenn Brummer stealing home plate. I will remember all of those things when I am an octogenarian. That is an ongoing story. Players will leave, managers will leave. They play in different stadiums. Sometimes they'll do something insane, like put an ad on the uniform or something. Like, all sorts of things will change in that time, but I won't, and fans won't. I will be following that team the entire time, that ongoing story. And I think that thing that made him great was he understood that. And he understood that this was, the Cardinals were a story that was both a bigger than this year's team or what this particular game, but also that this game and this team and this year was a vital chapter in that ongoing story. That to me is the beauty of someone that's been covering the team for so long. And frankly, as you look around other teams, increasingly rare. Someone that can be that sort of institutional memory of a franchise, and it's something that's pretty valuable.
Yeah, that's really well put. There's a real difference between being mean-spirited and being spirited. Yeah. And there was so much spirited in his coverage, just so much spirited. My late colleague Brian Burwell talked about every baseball season was a novel, a lot like you just described, and it unfolds and you have twists and turns and you don't know when the climax is going to come and there might be some plot twists. And he would constantly refer to baseball season as a novel. And I think we can call the writing that Rick did year after year after year classics, just stand out great.
And an ongoing magnum opus.
a 50 volume set. Just amazing. An amazing amount of work. Thank you for this and for chatting.
If you don't mind, Derek, sure. I don't want to put you on the spot or anything, but I mean, obviously, you, I mean, when I, I mean, when I heard about this, you were the first person I thought of. I don't want to, I'm sure you're still kind of processing a lot of stuff, but how are you holding up with this?
It's, you know, I sat there for, well, I spent 20 years next to him there to his right and learned so much about, the game. I'm forever in debt to him because you talk about how this is an everyday thing, right? And for me, part of my love, and I've told this, I probably bored you with this before, but my love of baseball, my love of newspapers are so intertwined because they're daily. And you have a ball player who goes out there and goes 0-for-3 and then has to come back to work the next day. You have a writer who goes out there and doesn't nail it and has to come back to work the next day. And you have to write through illness and heartbreak and migraines. And but the paper still goes out. There's still a porch out there that is thirsty for it. And I found a person who showed me more about the game that I love and more about the profession that I love because he loved it so in similar ways. And because of that, it means so much to me to have spent that time with him learning the game. A game that he adores, a game that I love, that he showed me new facets of, new ways to appreciate, new ways to think, new ways to look, and then the added element of new ways to write it and how to get through. I don't think there's any way that I'm a baseball writer at the Post-Dispatch still if not for him. He was my tether. I told him that multiple times. I'm like, you are my tether. You keep me in the soil, and you give me direction. And I think for me to have spent 20 years with someone who could enhance the love of two of my favorite things and make my appreciation for them deeper, I don't have words to describe that. Except for I feel it. I feel a fondness for baseball and a fondness for newspaper and a fondness for where they meet at baseball writing in a far deeper way because I was lucky enough to call Rick Hummel my mentor.
Thank you. Sorry, Derek.
No, thank you. He's the best. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closet by Design. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week by someone who I knew when they were merely special, and now they've gone on to be best-selling. Is, of course, contributing editor of New York Magazine, national correspondent for MLB.com, and here we go. You ready, Will? I think I'm going to nail this. Author of The Time Has Come. It's Will Leach. Did I get it all right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, excellent. Yeah, that was, you really nailed it. It's very weird as a regular listener to this show not to hear that. Dum, 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 dum. It's really hard. I'm having a really hard time with it. But
yeah, now you see the magic behind the curtain, right? Yeah. That I add that later. That I don't have.
I know, I'm sure. Fan. It's so weird.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I can hum it to you if you want me to.
That's okay. I think the listeners have already suffered enough by having me on the show.
I don't think that's true. I picked it out because it kind of sounds like a typewriter. Those years ago when Bernie Miklas and I started this thing, and I was like, well, what kind of lead-in music? And I was like, it kind of has a newsroom sound to it, back when there were newsrooms. So that's how I picked it. Of course, you also are a co-host with of Seeing Red. Is it a spinoff of the Best Podcast in Baseball?
No, because I was never involved with the Best Podcast in Baseball. So I think when
Bernie was,
I know Bernie was, but like Bernie, you know, I mean, I think like I. Listen, you remember doing the show with Bernie, so you can, you know, I just can't believe I talked Bernie into doing this thing with me. And so at a certain level, I would say that like if this is a long continuing show, I think of this as like the Brokaw, like Tom Brokaw. This is the Tom Brokaw show, except Tom Brokaw never retired. And now we're Brian Williams, but now we're comfortably in Lester Holt mold. So we're in Lester Holt land. But nevertheless, yeah. But I'm delighted to get to do it. Honestly, get to talk to. I grew up, you know, like I think a lot of people. I grew up reading Bernie, so it's very hard. A lot of times, we will have people listen to Seeing Red, and they'll be like, "Hey, we love the show; it's great." But we couldn't help but notice that every time Bernie says something, Will be like, "Yeah, man, that's totally right." Like it's totally like the Chris Farley show on Saturday Night Live. I'm like, "Yeah, man, remember that time that you wrote that piece after McGuire's six-second homer? That was awesome." So yeah, it's always hard not to do that on that show, but we have a good time.
Speaking of Bernie, you and Bernie have an event at Left Bank Books on May 25th, the evening of May 25th. Bernie will be quizzing you on your book, The Time Has Come. So that event is at Left Bank Books, May 25th.
And we will get some Cardinals talk in, to be as clear as possible.
When we first met, we were both special to the Post-Dispatch. You were the Illini correspondent, and I was the Mizzou correspondent. The early stages of your career were focused on sports writing, like, and that's what you didn't you aspired to be the Cardinals beat writer at one point in time, right? That was the goal.
I don't know if I wanted to be
a columnist.
I certainly wanted to. Sports was, it's funny, at the newspaper, the Daily Illini in college, I actually wanted to be a film critic because Roger Ebert was kind of my hero growing up.
Of course.
I really wanted to be a film critic. And then they paid us 85 cents per column inch last year, which bought a lot of beer over at Murphy's. So I was like, I'll cover sports too. And I had sort of a flair for writing. So I kept writing. And so I was writing for the Post-Dispatch. That was my great joke at the time. Because of course I saw that there was something. Oh, wait, there's a guy that covered that's also special to the Post-Dispatch. He covers Missouri. Okay, I don't. And so then I got my competitive juices going, and I said, "Okay, listen, I don't know what's going to happen in my career, but one thing I can guarantee, I'm going to have more bylines in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch than that guy." And that guy was you, and I don't think I'm going to catch up with you, Derek.
No, there's still time. I guess there's still time.
I don't like my odds, but yeah. So the point is, like, sports was always kind of accidental. And actually, my story about this is always that I actually covered – I went up to the press box one time. One of the first games I ever covered a press box at Illinois. It was an Illinois football game. And I was so excited. I was like into my freshman year. I was covering it. I'd be in the press box. This is amazing. I'm going to be in the press box. And I couldn't wait to meet everybody up there because I was like, wow, these people are going to be so happy. They get to go to the games for free. People give them food. They get to talk to the athletes. They have great seats. I can't wait to meet all of these really happy people that I will meet up in that press box. And then I went up there and everyone was like, the food's cold. This game's taking too long. The athletes are boring. And I literally remember walking out to my girlfriend, my college girlfriend at the time, and saying, "Well, I don't know what I'm going to do with my career, but I am not working in sports. Wow, those guys are so unhappy." And so I actually tried to avoid it for a really long time. But then I still wrote about sports because I love sports. And I like to write about things that I care about. But doing it as a career, I was always wary of it. And then I sort of fell backwards into it with Deadspin.
I wonder to ask you, like, how those that the time covering sport or writing about sports, particularly for Deadspin, and having kind of sometimes you often wrote like a voice of the fan, maybe the voice of the sarcastic fan, and I wonder how that informed like the characters you create for your novels, like how that kind of put the foundation down for understanding fandom and interest and maybe even how a profession comes to define someone.
You know, it's funny. The perspective of Deadspin was very much from the fan perspective. But what it really was, and I think one of the general thesis of Deadspin was that it was from an outsider perspective. And fans, even though I feel obliged to remind everyone, the fans are the ones that pay for all of this, they're inevitably an outsider perspective. The general idea of Deadspin was to try to bridge the gap between the people who worked in sports, and whether they were in media, whether they were worked for the teams, whether they worked for the leagues, whether they worked for networks or whatever it was, or players or managers or whoever it was, and the people that actually that care so passionately about this and pay for everything. There seemed to be a huge gap between those people. And the idea was to, in a hopefully amusing fashion, bridge that gap a little bit and in a way, and just get rid of that illusion that, that there was some sort of actual line there. That, that is different from saying there's no difference between a reporter and just some random message board person. There is. I'm not saying that, but I did feel that like that gap between, it felt like there was a line between people that worked in sports and people that didn't. And I did feel that I like to write from the perspective, outsider's the wrong way to put it, because it makes it sound like I'm a rebel. I sit on the outside and I say things that people don't dare say. And I don't think that that's, I don't, first of all, I don't think I write that way. But secondly, I don't think that's not what I mean by outsiders. I think it's more like one of the things I love writing about fiction in the same way that writing about sports is I've seen you in locker rooms. I've done reporting stuff, but I actually find it a lot more interesting, and it certainly makes my writing better to try to go out as far as I can and get as much perspective about these as I can. I write a weekly column about sports for New York Magazine, and a lot of that I feel is informed by the idea that while I love sports, I am not as invested in the day-to-day of it as maybe a beat reporter is. And that means that there's a billion things that I can't do. There's a billion things that I will fail at and uninformed on. But I also hopefully it allows me to give a little bit of a perspective and step back from a little bit. And hopefully that informs the fiction writing as well, in that a lot of it is observational. You know, the book takes place in Athens, Georgia. And it follows like all these different kind of characters who are all very different people. They're all very different people from one another. They're all very different people than me. One of the things I've been finding very satisfying when people read the book, they're like, I can't tell which one of the characters is you. I'm like, ooh, good sign. That's what we want. That's what we're looking for. That's exactly what we want, because I find it, it's fun for me. And particularly this may be true as I've gotten older, as my life, as we all kind of know, notice my life as I've gotten older has become a lot less interesting. I get up, I take the kids to school, I run, I ride all day, I pick them up, and then that's pretty much, and then I watch the Cardinals game before I go to bed. And that's pretty much what my life is now. And so it's much more interesting to, I like writing about people that are a lot more interesting than me, so I can observe other people. And I feel like the way that I write about sports is very connected to the way that I write my fiction, because it really is from that quiet outsider observer thing that there's stuff that, because I'm not close, I'm going to miss. But also I hopefully this is the theory of the case anyway, the farther back that I am, the more I can kind of notice things that maybe people that are too close won't.
The novel you have that just came out is called The Time Has Come, and you have an event May 25th at Left Bank Books with the aforementioned Bernie Miklas. And I do want to like dive into the book throughout this whole conversation, but I'm going to try to stitch it together and get your thoughts on the Cardinals as well. But what really struck me, and the reason why I was asking about like how sports help you kind of create either characters or stories, is because in the book you have a father and son who have differences. The father feels like he is not intellectually at the same level as his son, and there's some political differences between the two of them, particularly how active in some ways the son is, but they have baseball, and you know the son is good at baseball, and this means a lot to his father and loves baseball. And I got a kick out of like that being a touchstone that you could, in a few words, like all the readers go, no, I get how sports is kind of a connection that bridges over troubled waters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always, you know, my father and I do not have entirely different political opinions, maybe a little bit more because he's older than I am. But generally speaking, we're different people, you know, and I think a lot of people have that. My previous book, Are We Winning, which was about a Cardinals and Cubs game, was kind of touched on this as well. No matter what's happening, this is the old city slickers joke, right? Like no matter what was happening, we could always talk about baseball. And I think there's an element of truth to that. But I actually think that's true increasingly across the board. One of the really fun things I've actually kind of enjoyed about this baseball season. You know, I was really worried. I was worried about the pitch clock, and I was worried about pitch clock, not because I didn't think it would work, because I actually felt that I think there'd been enough success in the minor leagues that it felt like this could work. This will shorten games. And it seems like the players don't tend to dislike it that much. What I was worried about, though, was one of the things that baseball, the things I find exhausting about baseball, this is why I don't like talking about the Hall of Fame anymore, is that like it feels like a lot of baseball discussions are just people fighting with each other about things that aren't really baseball. They're more like generational. It's whether where you stand on steroids or where you stand on the way the game is played and all that sort of stuff. And it seems like not things about the actual joy of the game itself, the actual experience of going to a game where I find when I am at a game and sitting with my family or sitting with someone I care about in the stands, I'm not actually having any of those debates. Or if they are, they're playful. And it feels like in a social media age and a hot take age, everyone has to fight with each other about all of these things. And so I was worried about the pitch clock. So I thought, oh man, is this going to become another sort of like, in my day, we didn't need the pitch clock. Well, you don't understand the way baseball is going to be in the future and all the fights that we see all the time and so on. And we haven't seen it. We haven't seen that in a way that's been, it's been really nice in a way that like baseball to me is one of those things, and I love all sports, but baseball's my sport and the Cardinals are my team. And a lot of that is all based in this idea of it is a place where I can get away. And I think a lot of people can get away from the chaos and the uncertainty and the sometimes fear that kind of runs our regular life. And so I hate it when baseball's involved in that. I hate it when baseball gets dragged into that stuff. And I think that's a nice thing that I think anyone can have. I think those Jason and Jace are the characters of the book, and certainly my dad. And I think a lot of people can have that experience where they can step away from all of that stuff and really get into and just be go away and just watch the baseball. And listen, I understand this was a big thing with at the end of Deadspin, when the idea of stick to sports and politics whether you can separate them two or whether you cannot separate them. I think in an intellectual sense, you cannot separate sports and politics. In an intellectual sense, you absolutely cannot. There's no way, like every decision you make going to a game, forget just the anthem, how you got to the game, how you purchase your tickets, who sits in the fancy seats and who sits in the cheaper seats. We'll talk about this in St. Louis, the buildings that surround the stadium and who owns them and who paid for them and so on. All of that is politics. But certainly when I'm at a game, that's not what I want to be thinking about all the time. That doesn't mean you can't do both, but I like to be able to have that separation in the experience of watching a game so I can have that moment where I can talk to my father or someone, I can talk to someone who I may differ on something. I love that when I go to a Cardinals game, I'm sure I'm surrounded by people that probably disagree with me on so many things, which is fine. They're whole other people. Why would they agree with me on everything? They're not the same people. It's totally fine. But when I'm at a Cardinals game, they're my best friends. And that to me is something like is almost sacred about baseball that I always really, really value.
I like that. I like that a lot. That touches on one of my concerns about the pitch clock, one of my subtle pitch timer, I guess we're supposed to call it. But one of the subtle things that I have been concerned about, and the pitch timer relates to it, is that baseball's squeezing the stories out of it. You think about some of the layoffs and some of the changes to, you know, to staffs that came after 2020 or that came as a result of the Astros downsizing their scouting staff and everybody going, oh, well, we can do this on computers with, you know, and watch from St. Louis. We don't need to send out all these scouts. I think one of the things it's done is you see a lot of the great storytellers in baseball, the guys who have been in the minors and collect these amazing anecdotes and pass them along as legend and as, you know, fables almost, where they're trying to teach the young players, you know, habits and personalities and history and everything through these great stories. You know, like the great joke tellers. We see so many of them leaving the game, and I worry that they're taking their stories with them, and in their place is less time within a game to tell those stories.
And I understand that, and I am certainly empathetic to it. I would also say that right now it feels like I like the pitch clock, but I agree that it feels faster. It feels like that, particularly you hear from broadcasts and you, I agree. It feels faster. I feel like this is still the first year. Yeah. And I feel like there is going to be, here's what kind of my gauge for when this is, we're going to be in a comfortable place with this. When the broadcasts are no longer showing the clock. That is actually interesting. That is my, that I think eventually broadcasts are going to realize, okay, we've got the pace now. The game is about 15 or 20 minutes shorter. Because I have to say, I like the pitch clock. I don't actually like seeing the pitch clock. I don't. Interesting. There's never been a time where I've watched a game and thought, oh, he better hustle. it's not something like I don't feel like when I want to see a sport clock in any other sport, I'm like, well, he better hurry up and get that ball snapped, or he better get this shot off. But I don't find myself watching a baseball game thinking, well, Gallegos better hustle or he's going to get a ball here. Like, I feel like the clock is actually that what the clock now feels like an instructive sort of, okay, just to remind you, the clock is happening. But I think once everybody gets used to it, I don't think we're going to need to see the clock. And I think everything is going to, I think the general idea of the pitch clock is to set a new pace. And right now that pace feels really fast to someone that, like you and I, that have been watching baseball our entire lives. It feels like, wow, that this is a time where Mike Shannon would have told a really funny story about having steaks with Sinatra or something. Or Jim Edmonds would go off on whatever happens to see when he's looking at his cell phone right now. I actually like Jim Edmonds. I know he gets some criticism online, but I actually like Jim Edmonds, the broadcaster. But that kind of like...
Wait, criticism online? No way.
I know, of all places, right? Right.
That's amazing.
I know. But anyway, the point is that I feel... it feels like those little leisurely things are missing right now. Mm-hmm. I also think that's part of the adjustment period. I think that's part of the, and that's why I always say when they start to realize we don't need to show the clock anymore, because now the pace is now set. The pace is now different. I think you're already starting to see some comfort in it. You're seeing it in the minor leagues. Minor leagues, I don't think they even think about this stuff anymore. And so I think that to me is what the goal of I think this was, and why I like where it eventually will get. There are little tweaks I'd like to see here or there. My biggest concern, and maybe I'll be worried, maybe this is an unnecessary worry. To me, so much of the fun of the postseason is those big moments late.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And the moment where the camera comes in on the pitcher, you can see his nose hair as he's just focusing in. There's the batter, and there's that the crowd is all revved up. That to me is that's why postseason baseball is different than regular season baseball. Why it means so much, and those are the moments I think of. It certainly would strike me as a really tragic thing if that moment is stopped.
Yeah.
By someone getting a ball or a strike. I know they haven't adjusted that. And maybe by the time we get to the postseason, players will all be so used to it. Managers to me also used to it. That's the thing I found encouraging about this. I was fully expecting managers, players, and specifically umpires, who have the ones that have everything that's been put on them through those things. I thought we'd see more pushback. We haven't seen much. I think Andrew McCutchen said something yesterday about injuries, that he's worried about injuries being an issue. But on the whole, people seem the people involved in the game seem to like it. From the games I've been to, sometimes I was at that game where Sandy Alcantara threw a 1-0 shutout. In Miami. I was actually at that game with my son. Game with an hour and 57 minutes. That is, on the whole, too fast. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That seems too fast. But it was also maybe that's not too fast for a 1-0 game where there was a total of 6 hits. So yeah. Maybe that's when that should go. So I think it's all an adjustment period. But to me, getting the base level of pace to where everyone is comfortable and used, I think we'll used to it will still lead to that thing that I share with you of being concerned about losing. I think it's a matter of understanding that pace. Right now, you can still hear broadcasters kind of rush. There's a great piece in The Athletic about this, right? About how they have to kind of rush it a little bit. I think it'll meet its natural level at some point.
The Cardinals are usually good for a cameo in your books, if not more.
Yes. There is one small cameo in the book.
Oh, can I give it away?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah, they make an appearance in this current book, The Time Has Come, as a neck tattoo, which is very subtle. So all of a sudden, out of nowhere, into the narrative, pops a St. Louis Cardinals neck tattoo. I wondered earlier, a few weeks ago, they were saying that if the Cardinals can come out of their fog, Miles Michaelis said it'll be a Disney movie. I'm wondering now, as a novelist, what you make of the Cardinals. And the title of your book, The Time Has Come, certainly could apply to the May that they've had. The time has come to finally win. But are you seeing a real turnaround here, or is this a red herring? What narrative moment are we in here with the Cardinals?
You know, it's funny. I find myself wanting to resist the narrative that I suspect if the run we've seen in May continues, which is far from assured, by the way. Yeah. Like, this is really fun right now, but like, I mean, the Cardinals are playing great right now. There's a terrific, it's been as good a homestand as that you've seen in a while. But I mean, they're still 6 games under 500. like that's the hole that they dug for themselves. All it takes is 1 week where things, they're really good and things still go wrong, because that's what happens in baseball sometimes. They dug themselves, obviously, a pretty huge hole. But I am the thing that I worry about is, listen, you've been obviously very close in the reporting on this. What happened with the Contreras thing? Well, listen, I disagreed with the decision. I did not feel that there was really any sort of logical explanation really put together for the extension, for the decision to take Contreras out, which I also would argue is part of the problem over there. I think, and again, you are closer to this than I am, but certainly there is a sense of it certainly seems the organization has tried to become more of a closed circle than perhaps it was 10, 15 years ago. And so, and sometimes that's, which can be fine. You can, it preserves leaks, stops leaks. It can also become a, you know, a silo and a self-fulfilling prophecy and maybe a closed circle in a way that they miss stuff. Certainly the fact that when Contreras came back and they kind of have gone on this run, and Contreras had that wonderful week in Chicago, which, and the way he has handled himself. The one thing I'm very resistant and do not want to hear if the Cardinals pull this around is someone from the Cardinals front office organization saying, see, we had a plan the whole time. We had a plan the whole time. And you, I can smell it. You can totally smell it coming. If they like, see, listen, we got all of this criticism. And Derek, tell me, you've been covering the team for so long. I don't remember a time that nationally they have taken the heat that they took that week. I don't, like, there have been criticism, and they certainly, there's whispers like they got rid of too many outfielders, they were maybe too rash with managers. And I think there's still some national confusion about the Schilt thing. I've never seen everyone from stat heads to Ken Rosenthal to your Buster Olney and all your national people be like, wait, what is going on over there? I've never seen that. Had you seen it with that intensity before?
I'm trying to think. I want to not, probably nothing for that kind of decision. You know, nothing like that. And part of that is because they obviously have a lot of respect. Mozeliak does and everything like that.
If it happened all the time, they wouldn't be in charge right now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, and that's kind of what I tried to write at the time was like, and this was my theory was, this is like an organization that is used to everything going well and contending and winning, having no idea how to stop losing.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that kept coming up was the young players and how they were experiencing failure for the first time and how that takes an adjustment and they have to trust what they're doing. And I'm like, well, that's what this whole organization is going through.
Yeah.
And you look at, I remember talking to Mozeliak, John Mozeliak, president of baseball operations in San Francisco. And, you know, 48 hours after they designate Motter for assignment, they're signing him back as a free agent. And I'm like, I asked him, Mo, I'm like, this is a chaotic use of your roster. That is something that you're allergic to. Like, you go out of your way sometimes, you know, clogging the roster and having to make decisions you don't want to, but you go out of your way to preserve assets and not have to make transactions like this. What is going, I go, you can't be comfortable with this chaos. And he looked at me like, I'm not, you know, but they were losing and it looked like they were just trying to thrash around for a foothold. And that continued with, you know, 2 days of work time for Jordan Walker, working with the hitting coaches to then demote it. Then you think about like how they approach Zach Thompson, right? He's been effective. He's had 2 back-to-back appearances where he allows 2 runs. And then all of a sudden, you know, he's going to the minors to stretch out to be a starter for 2024. Like, why are you making a decision for one of your best left-handed pitchers at the highest level? And essentially saying, yeah, we don't think we want that arm to contribute to this year just yet. We want it to contribute to next year. It just was an odd kind of bit of messaging. And then, of course, all of that came together with how they just couldn't quite sick, you know, how they approached the whole Contreras thing, having him take fly balls in left field, and then within a few days saying, no, he's not going to take left field. And they did it all on the eve of Chicago.
Will, what was your view of the affair de Contreras at the friendly confines?
Yeah, I mean, I think for what it's worth, I'm not obviously not the first person to say this, but the way he handled it, I think is in a way that's going to, if you had any question whether or not Wilson Contreras was going to vibe with Cardinals fans, I think that's very well answered now. I think the way that he handled that situation, to the point now that, for crying out loud, he's such a part. They like, clearly the team, the players love him so much through this, that game where they hit those seven homers, Paul DeJong did a bat flip, Derek. I can't believe I saw that. Like, they're like following what Wilson Contreras does in a lot of ways. The fans adored him after that. Inevitably, we got a Yachty Instagram post out of it. I do not believe this was, I'm sure this was not the intention, and I will not believe the Cardinals if later in the year they try to claim that it was. But it really couldn't have possibly endeared Contreras more to the fan base and clearly to his team, right?
Yeah.
And I think that, and I would argue not just the team kind of getting criticism in the wake of it, but even some of the pitchers getting some criticism in the wake of it. The idea of maybe not taking responsibility for their own issues and trying to put them on Contreras, I think that pushback on them, we'll see how that reflects out the rest of the season. But I think early returns have been at least shown some improvement in that regard. So I think that there's that. Well, it's funny, though. Like, I was on Ben Lindbergh's Effectively Wild podcast. And he was right after this happened. And it was before Contreras had been brought back to catch. And Ben asked me, he said, so like, what needs to happen? Like, what needs to get fixed first? What are the, if you could be the Cardinals, what would you do right now in the wake of all of this landing? I said, the first thing they need to do is get Wilson Contreras back behind the plate. That's the thing they need to do, regardless of not whether he solved his issues or not. They need to get him back there for a variety of reasons. One, just the public relations aspect of how much of a mess they've created for themselves. But also, again, it's a month into a 5-year contract. You need this. You need this guy back on your side, and so then they did that. But you know this. What's the old baseball line that like bad process, good results, good process, bad results, need to be suspicious of both of those. The idea, whatever thoughts, and again, you know, there have been some rumblings, you've had some reports, we've seen here or there some things leaking out, but I don't think there's really been a clear 100% holistic statement from the Cardinals that said, okay, here's what Contreras was doing wrong, and here's how we fix it, and now we're all set. Yeah, I think it was kind of clear that like, hey, it's been 5 days, he's back, America. And on a certain level, I think that was the right call. I would be suspicious to see if whatever exactly had to be resolved in those 5 days was really resolved. But I'm glad that he's back. And clearly, just from a roster management aspect, he kind of has to be back there. Mm-hmm. And never mind, not just this year, but years moving forward. So I'm, if you take a look, step back from it, it was really just a week. That week was the transition from the horrible start to the better team that they've been since. But I do not necessarily take those things as causation. And I'm suspicious if the team tries to, whatever issues they believe or did not believe or whatever happened. We talked about them flailing around and this kind of being a result of them. We have to do something. Let's try this. The idea that there was some sort of problem solved in that chaotic week before he came back to get behind the plate, I'm very suspicious of that idea. I think that this is a good team that had a disastrous start and it's now closer to being a better team again. The idea that it's with Contreras coming back is somehow related to it, I don't know.
If I had to do it again, I would have put it in the headline, but a subplot to this that I wrote about, and I should have done a better job of interjecting it into the conversation about Contreras, was not his catching at all, though that was discussed with him, and the sequencing of pitches and some of the predictable sequences that a few of the pitchers had, and then the frustration on Contreras' part that he felt like some of the pitchers weren't willing to execute the pitches that he wanted, the style that he wanted. But another part of this was alleviating the stress of that so he could just go rock at the plate. And they thought, rightly or wrongly, but internally, that he said he felt guilty catching them and their lack of success with two strikes and the lack of consistency. And what was discussed was, if we take some of the catching duties off of your plate and just say, go hit for a week, would that be fun again? And
messaging was not great about that.
Messaging was not non-existent about that.
Yeah.
I mean, they just wouldn't entertain that. And I don't know exactly why. I was able to confirm that and talk with folks about that. But the person to say that definitively, you know, they repeatedly declined. And I don't know why. I don't know if they didn't want to say that about his offense, but he was wearing it. And then he goes to Wrigley and he does the hand gestures. He has just the time of his life turning heel at Wrigley. And you could see some of that. I mean, he didn't like have a bunch of hits, but he did have a big game offensively. And you could see some of that melt away, right? Like that frustration, that weight, and then now carry that back to also being a catcher. So I think
were they shocked by the backlash? Were they surprised how much they hit?
No, they knew it was coming.
Wow. Then why didn't they have a messaging ready? Like, that's what's so confusing to me. Like, particularly because the reason I'm surprised, even kind of surprised that they were not surprised, is it felt like every day Mo would do like a new cleanup that would just kind of make it a little worse. To me, the weirdest thing was when Rosenthal asked him about, like, do you, like, when they threw Sean Murphy into it. And like, when Rosenthal asked him, like, well, now do you regret the Sean Murphy trade? And like, the answer there is no. not doing the Sean Murphy trade.
Right.
But the answer there to me is very obviously no. Even if you do, which I would hope he doesn't, but even if you do, that allows Rosenthal to write, some of the people thought in the trade were Brendan Donovan and Lars Nootbaar. Like, and then there's a quote from Mo saying, well, you know, when I go, who can go back and change the past, right? We got to go with moving forward. It's like, wait, now Nootbaar's been thrown under the bus, for crying out loud. Like, it felt like the cleanup on that, frankly, a lot of the moves themselves looked frantic.
Yeah.
Looked frantic in a way that is unusual for this organization.
I agree. And that was the chaos that I asked him about. I also was very interesting that what media outlet was being talked to, even what reporter was being talked to, was getting different things.
Yes. I noticed that as a reader as well, which I thought was very strange.
Yeah. I did too. And it was like, well, wait a minute. We talked to the same person and heard completely different things. Is that our ears? Is that what they're saying? What is that? Is that one person's cynicism? I don't know. I was trying to sort through. It will make you a fun time to revisit for a journalism class at a never time, but it would be an interesting discussion about, like, because the message one day was very different than the message the next, and the message that was the way it was described on KMOX was way different than it was a few hours later in another outlet. And I think one of the reasons why is, no, I know it's not, I think, I'm sorry. I know one of the reasons why is because they were aware of what they were trying to convey to Contreras and what they were trying to convey publicly. And I think they ran into problems when they didn't harmonize. And it's always difficult to remember, what phrase did I tell this person? What phrase did I tell that person? Who am I in each of the, you know, how am I different in these two conversations? And they just meshed and it became garbled. Not to be lost in this is, since they won every series. They won the series at Wrigley. They swept at Fenway. They did their historic baseball tour and got themselves right back on track in that road trip. Not back on track, but they found traction in quicksand, I guess. They learned how to tread quicksand. And then come home, beat Milwaukee, beat the Dodgers in a four-game series, that win that, which leads me to the question, are you buying this? Are you real? Are you on board with the Disney movie?
I don't know if I'm quite in Disney movie mode, but I, you know, this is closer to the team they are. And frankly, they're going to have to kind of play like this after that first month. I think we've all done like the math, right? To be like, wow, so if they're going to get the 90 wins, they have to play at this pace or this pace.
700 baseball.
Yeah, yeah. And for the next 3 weeks, they did, right? They put themselves in a position to be back in it. But that's the thing. You know, we're talking after their Monday night loss. That was a frustrating loss. So I got like 8-9 walks thing, and they just could not get the big hit. Those games happen throughout the season. Games where the Cardinals were clearly the better team than the Reds on Monday night. They just – things didn't sequence right and things didn't happen right and they just lost. And that's frustrating. And there was a wild pitch in the, things didn't go out exactly the way they wanted, but you know, those games happen. The problem is after that first month, those games are now like, you can't have very many more of those. Mm-hmm. And that to me is the thing I still worry about the team for all the, wow, they're really running. They're really back in a good spot. They're still 7 games under 500. I think that there's this idea that because it was so bad and they've had these good series, like, all right, back on track. No, they're not back on track. Like, they're still 5 games out of first. They're still 7 games under 500. And yes, the schedule eases up, and I think there's reason to feel optimistic moving forward. To me, I think that I think a bigger part of this is the fact that the Cubs, while the Cardinals have done this, the Cubs have, the bomb has fallen out of the Cubs. The Pirates have come back to reality. The Brewers seem to be having some issues, injury related and otherwise, that they don't look like, this feels like a year where you can win this division with 88 or 89 wins.
Yeah, I mean, that's the guiding light here, is they are still in it because they're in the National League, and the National League has not been good.
Yeah, and that's a big advantage. That is a big advantage. Yeah. But like that said, I still, like, for what it's worth, another thing that would have helped them on Monday night would have been better starting pitching. Like, that also would have helped them. And so, like, you know, that issue has not gone away. And no. I think that, you know, that was what we all talked about after that first month, that even before the Contreras thing, the answer of what's wrong with the Cardinals, Eno Saris wrote about this very well for Fangraphs, or should be for the Athletic, kind of talking about like, yeah, well, we all tried to warn them that the starting pitcher is not going to be there. And so the idea, like, now they're hitting like crazy, and there's and like what Gorman has done and what DeJong has done and Arenado coming back, clearly the hitting is all clicking. That is kind of, and listen, Michaelis has gotten back on track. Flaherty's been a little bit better. Mats has been a little bit better. I still don't look at this rotation and think, oh, this is still enough to maintain. And so I don't. That is my concern with them moving forward. They're clearly a better team than they were in the first month. But the worry about this team is the same worry we had in that first month and the same worry we had going into the season, which is that rotation. You, one of the many great things you do as a beat reporter, Derek, is you constantly remind the team and us as readers that innings matter. Yeah. Innings are totally, totally important. And it feels like they kind of try to slough that off a little bit every year, particularly now when you are, like, the problem is the Cardinals can get back to 500. I think they clearly have the talent to get back going, but they're going to have to do this extra effort just to get back there. Mm-hmm. There will be wear and tear. I think that will happen as they fight to get back going up there. And so I'm not putting the idea of another spring or two flying loose out of the question.
It was pretty predictable what's going to happen when you get the 2023 schedule. And I'll tell you what's ahead, too. You look at the schedule and you saw that just absolute gauntlet of Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles. I called it the Huey Lewis road trip because it was the heart of rock and roll, right? And just you knew that early in the season with that rotation and just the nature of the grind as it begins and so few off days, it was like that's going to go poorly for them. And you knew it, and it went worse than it possibly could have gone. And they have one on the horizon. So I'm telling you, as a service to you, Cardinal fan, that this is the soft, this is the time to make up ground. This is the time of the schedule where they have to do that. Cincinnati, Cleveland, Kansas City, I guess the Ohio River tour. I'm not sure what to call it. But this is the time to make up that ground, because out there in the distance is London. And it's not London that is the trip. It's the return. And while it goes Mets, the long trip is Mets, Washington. So Queens, D.C., London for several days, 2 games, but then return. 1 day off.
And one, a home day. Stay. One day. One day off.
1 day off. And then Houston and the Yankees.
And if there is another bear trap in this schedule where they get close to 500 and then tumble again, it's there. They have to do well in that stretch or they won't win. It's an oracle, you know, this year. The schedule tells you.
And I will be in London, by the way. I can't wait. This is my first time my parents have gone to, got the passport for this trip. So I'm very excited to be out there. I think it's going to be great. But yeah, I mean, this is a year. I couldn't believe there was only one day between. I tell you, I'm going to need more than one day coming back from that trip. So I'm really impressed that they're going to do it. And I think that's the problem with that start. Like, again, it is. Listen, the nightmare has been avoided. There was legitimately a moment at the end of April, and particularly that Angel series, where I thought, well, geez, what the heck am I going to do with my summer now? I had to wonder, is this going to careen entirely out of control? They have avoided that, and it's been fun baseball, and we can see it. But the pitching is still the starting pitching. And I think there's a lot of great things about this team, and it does feel like the season is not going to careen off the rails. But I think there's reason to they have to pedal really, really hard for a while just to get back to sea level. And I think that's going to leave some marks.
I am talking with contributing editor of New York Magazine, national correspondent for MLB.com, Will Leach, and, of course, author of The Time Has Come. He has an event with Bernie Miklas at Left Bank Books in St. Louis on May 25th. Go there, get a book signed, and Will, tell us about your book. It's a little bit Canterbury Tales. It's a little bit mystery. It's these stories of pilgrims who all meet on a climactic night at a historic family. A cornerstone of a neighborhood. Pharmacy?
Yeah, it's a pharmacy. Yeah, but the old, we all have those. Remember those old time pharmacies before CVS and Walgreens all kind of came and ate them up. Where you go to the soda fountain, get a grilled cheese and bacon for $1.75 and a milkshake, and also get your prescriptions. They've got tin York peppermint patties at the checkout. We still have one of those here in Athens. I think some towns certainly have them. And yeah, the base of the plot of the book, it's actually inspired by the Robert Altman movie Shortcuts or Paul Thomas Anderson movie Magnolia, where you follow basically five or six different characters throughout the span of one day. And what happens is you open the book with a woman named Tina Lamb. Tina is the book takes place in June 2021. She has been in isolation for a long time. She's been disturbed. She's kind of gone down some online rabbit holes, and she believes something truly terrible is going to happen at this pharmacy at 5:24, and she's the only one that can be there to stop it. And so she's literally talks about she has gotten armed, and she's going to go in and stop what's happening there. And then we follow these six other characters throughout their day leading up to 5:24 on June 24th, and we see them all culminate in that place. So hopefully the idea, like with Magnolia and like with Shortcuts, is you follow these characters throughout the course of their day, not only get to care about them, but recognize that there's also a clock, right? There's like they're in peril without them even realizing they're in peril. And so you learn their stories, and in a lot of ways find out what happens when all of these people culminate on this time. It's hopefully funny. It's hopefully kind of the moment in a lot of ways. And certainly everybody had their way to try to process what the last two or three years have been like. This is how I process it. It was writing about all the different ways that we all tried to keep our act together.
Did it begin with you thinking, I want to try to capture what it was like and what it was like emerging from quarantine? Was that sort of the beginning of the story for you? There's a really powerful description in the book where you talk about how someone who dies in March 2020 has a very different experience, or their family has a very different experience than someone who dies in April 2020. Especially in Georgia, as you describe.
Yeah, you know, certainly I think, you know, one of the things I found myself saying a lot throughout 2020, when I think it's fair to say people were very dialed up one way or the other, was I always tried to remember that no matter how someone's acting, even if someone that I've always known for a long time and maybe doing things that I would consider out of character, nobody is at their best. right now. It was like kind of my mantra to remember throughout that year, even kind of emerging from that. And I wanted to write about what it was like to get to having gone through this collective traumatic experience. Because, you know, one of the things we talk about all the time in the kind of American culture is we're all kind of in our silos, right? There's not a lot of universal monoculture anymore. There's just things happen to me and things happen to you, and they can be entirely separate. And I, the one thing that to me that was very dramatic about the pandemic, everybody on the planet was affected by the pandemic in one way or the other. And whatever your thoughts was, whatever happened to you, you couldn't hide from it. We all experienced. And so I one of my dirty secrets about the world is I'm really, really optimistic about it. It's quite stupid. But I'm really optimistic. I really truly believe this is a theme of How Lucky, my last book as well. I actually do believe people are good and want to help people. Now, we have our fears. We have the things that we have our biases. We have our problems. Everybody has their issues. And sometimes those get in the way of what I think people inherently want to do good. But I think people do want to do that. And I think the struggle of having gone through this collective traumatic experience and forgetting that we are all actually living together and have to work together and help each other is something that I wanted to try to capture in a story that was also kind of hopefully suspenseful and funny. Like I try to make jokes, you know, I try to make it a fun read. It's certainly a quick read, but I wanted to capture, I think that we forget sometimes that we are in fact connected to everyone around us. So we are all actually on this same big dumb rock together. And we live in a world where it's constantly trying to make us think that's not the case. And so I wanted to write a story about six or seven people that don't know each other and aren't connected, but are in ways they don't quite necessarily realize. And then in a big dramatic moment, have a way where they come together and hopefully work together to get through a difficult situation.
We've touched on movies a few times, your love of Roger Ebert and also the inspiration for your book. There are definitely cinematic stretches of the book. You can definitely see like the influence of movies in it. And that shared experience that you're describing, it's, you know, we have it sometimes in blockbusters, right? Like Indiana Jones for a lot of people is going to be a shared experience when it hits theaters. And I think of like Top Gun and what like a cultural kind of touchstone that was for movie fans, because you went back to the theater to see it. And you come out of this, like you describe, a shared global event. And while Top Gun may put you back in that silo, it's still a pretty big silo for people experiencing that exhilaration of being in the movie theater again. What role do you think sports play post pandemic? Are they stronger? Are they weaker? Are they different in any way?
I think there was definitely an initial period. Do you remember that stretch, particularly when the NBA was starting to get back games in, where there was a lot of fan misbehavior? Mm-hmm. There was a real stretch where that was happening on a regular basis. And to me, that was less because fans are jerks now and more that like it took everyone a while to remember how you're supposed to act in public. Huh. And sports was one of those things that people were back collecting. Like my first real big collective experience that I had was I'm a New York Knicks basketball fan, and they played the Atlanta Hawks in the playoffs that year, and Atlanta had full capacity for those playoff games. And I had both my shots. I was very comfortable going out, and it was wonderful. My team got killed, but it was wonderful. Like I found the beer tasted better, and the lights were brighter. I went to if you remember, the first series of that 2021 season for the Cardinals was in Miami. They were actually in Miami, and we were on our spring break that year. I think my kids go and my family goes to spring break every year, and we went to that game. Carlson, I think, hit a 3-run homer, and they were still doing reduced capacity, and everyone was wearing masks in the stands. But just like being around and being in that place, one of the things I told myself when in the depths of isolation and the pandemic, when I was like so desperate to watch a sporting event, I would like watch like wasps race each other across the lawn. And then, wait, they may be mating. I don't know if they're racing each other. And so at a certain level, I was so desperate to kind of have that. I said, I'm going to go to the game. I'm going to go to the concert. I'm going to go to the thing. I'm going to like say yes. Our friend Matthew Leach always talks about this. Say yes to the show. Go to the thing. And I've tried to like remember that. And I think you see this at some of these games. I would argue when you're at a game that is super, super exciting, there's a loudness and a vibe that is a little louder than we saw. Maybe this starts dissipating a little bit now, but certainly in 2020, late 2021 and parts of 2022, there was a oh my gosh, I'm so glad we're here. So glad we're here. And listen, sometimes that can manifest in bad things, but I also think that we're closer to our emotions now. I would argue this, as frustrating as that first month is, I don't think it's a coincidence that right now is the loudest I've ever heard boos at Busch Stadium. Yeah. I think like emotions are, we're quicker to get to emotions now. We're quicker to react to things. And I think a lot of it is having come through this big traumatic experience and still kind of wrestling with it a little bit. But for me, you know, to be at a sporting event, I appreciate it more. And I think people appreciate it more because you were in the press box. You were in the press box. I mean, that one of the things that was so incredible about watching you cover the team in 2020 was you insisted on going. I think it was at Illinois. It was at the White Sox that you couldn't go.
I was outside the ballpark. They wouldn't let me in.
Yeah, exactly. And so I, because you were out of state, that's where we were at that time.
Well, because I had come from Milwaukee.
Exactly.
And they knew it. Yeah. And I'm like, well, I can't hide that. I was there. And they're like, yeah. I'm like, so was the team, pretty famously. And like, it was a whole thing. I'm like,
it already sounds insane now, right? It already sounds
insane. Test me at the door. Yeah, test me at the door.
Yeah.
But we only have so many tests. Okay.
Exactly, right? Like that's a crazy thing that we went to just like less than 3 years ago.
Yeah.
That we went through that 2.5 years ago. And I think there is a natural urge, and I have it as well, to get back to normal. And to get back to normal and try to – and I get it. I want that. I have embraced that myself. But I also think that with that, there's been a rush to move on from what was a big collective, quite surreal experience. If you ever get a chance, go watch highlights from a game, one of those Fox games in 2020 where they had the digital fans in the crowd.
Yeah.
It is like a dystopian, weird, wild thing to watch. And it wasn't very long ago.
No.
So, I it feels farther away than watching like highlights of the 2019 World Series does.
Oh,
and I think that's a very kind of interesting experience.
Well, the novel is The Time Has Come, and it does intersect with your previous novel, which was fantastic, How Lucky, award-winning and best-selling, and Braves by Stephen King. And I wanted to end here by asking you, are you turning Athens into your own kind of personal Yucknapatawpha County or Castle Rock?
The thing I love about Athens is something I kind of touched on earlier, the idea that there are so many different types of people that live here. You know, like we all have our silos. I lived in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn for 8 years, and I had a hard time finding anyone that disagreed with me about anything. And if I go back to Mattoon, Illinois, my hometown, I guarantee you it's going to be a hard time to find people who disagree with each other there. The thing I love about Athens, it's a college town, like a lot of great college towns. There's a lot of different types of people that have to converge on one another. And so I like writing about people. My books have plots, but I'm interested in people first. And I like different types of people. I like different types of people than me. One thing I've discovered about myself as I've gotten older, Derek, is I'm a lot less interesting than I used to be. I get up, I go for a run, I take the kids to school, I ride all day, and I watch a Cardinals game and go to sleep. And I don't live a very interesting life. I like to live through other people a lot of ways. And having a place like Athens that has so many different types of people and so many different types of stories, I find that an infinite – I don't know if I'm going to set everything in Athens, but there are still more stories to be told here. There's no question.
So you are. So it's Will Leach's Castle Rock.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There will be that streaming series in 30 years of inspired from my work.
Right. Wait, do you have a horror novel just to slip in there is the question.
My dirty secret about writing books is I never know what genres my books are.
Oh.
I just make them. And it's always weird for me. Like a book can be anything. It's like a bunch of blank pages. You can make them do whatever you want. It feels weird to say, let's make this one follow this plot point, this plot point, this point, so it can fit on this shelf in the supermarket. I like to just make the stories and people can classify them. However.
I love it. I love that description. That's good. Just write, let other people decide. That's good. That's really good. This has been a great conversation, Will. It's good to catch up. Congratulations on the book. I wish that I could be in town because I love any excuse to go to Left Bank Books there in the Central West End. And of course, seeing two friends chat about books would be, that's like the hat trick of events for me. So they got postcards there, they got books and two friends talking books. So it'd be great. Again, congrats and thank you for taking this time and taking this conversation. And hopefully I can find you for a pint in London.
You do not have to ask me twice. I will be there with the Leach family, and I cannot wait. I cannot wait for London. Like I've never actually been to London, and so it is telling that that's how you get the Leach family to London. Give them that famous English thing of baseball and Bud Light. That will be, as we all know, what do Londoners famously love more than Midwestern baseball rivalries and Anheuser-Busch products?
Well, if you need any tips, man, I love London. I've been there multiple times.
I can't wait.
I will happily tell you what beers to try, what pubs to visit, and what hand gestures not to make.
I will need information on all three of those things.
That's contributing editor of the New York Magazine, national correspondent for MLB.com, and of course, author of The Time Has Come. It's available wherever you get your books, but especially at independent bookstores like Left Bank Books, where Will and Bernie Miklas will be having an event May 25th, the evening of May 25th at Left Bank Books there in the Central West End in St. Louis. I hope it's a packed house. I hope it's an amazing conversation. And Will, I will bother you again to be on the podcast just so we can compete with Seeing Red, your podcast with Bernie Miklas. Deal?
And you got to come on with us sometime, for crying out loud. I'd love to have you and Bernie sometime. I'll probably just be silent that entire show.
I don't think I'll get a word in edgewise. Are you kidding me? This has been the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, all the Constant Cardinals coverage is available at stltoday.com. Will, thank you very much for the best podcast in baseball and author Will Leach. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you soon. Thank you again, Will. Thank you.
Please. Thanks, man.